This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon about the Jewish Passover, and our guest in the studio is the director of the Champaign-Urbana Jewish Federation, Lee Malhado. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, Dr. Malhado, what is a Passover Seder?
Well, the Passover Seder is the meal that celebrates the holiday of Passover. It's usually a big family affair, and many times many friends are invited as well.
And when does it begin this year?
This year, the first Seder is on April 12th. And for those who celebrate a second Seder, it's the second night, so that would be the 13th. And Passover lasts, depending on which place in the Jewish spectrum you are, it lasts 7 days for Reform Jews and 8 days for Conservative and Orthodox Jews, unless you're in Israel, in which case it's 7 days for everybody.
I see. Now, the preparation has already begun. Is this a happy thing to do? Are people pleased to start preparing for the Seder, the Passover, or is there a lot of stress involved?
Well, I think the answer is yes and yes.
Okay.
It's usually a lot of fun and a lot of excitement. Children are generally engaged in the preparations as well. And it's also, depending on how rigorously you celebrate it, it can be quite stressful. The goal is to arrange it in the family so that it's as little stress and as much joy as possible.
And who's in charge of that?
Well, that varies from family to family. The way we divide it up in my house is that my husband, who is the one who cares the most that things be ritually correct, over the years we've worked on an arrangement where he takes charge of the kitchen and the cooking utensils, and I take charge of the whole rest of the house, and we sort of share the shopping, and I do most of the cooking, although he helps.
Well, tell us what has to be done.
Well, one of the commandments that you have to follow is that there will be no chametz, either that you will not eat any chametz or own any chametz. And chametz is leavened bread of any kind, crackers, bread,
whatever. Something with yeast in it.
Something with yeast in it. And in addition to products that people might directly recognize as bread, the rabbis over the years have expanded the definition of chametz to include other related things so that it's not just wheat, but it's also barley, spelt, oats. They're five grains. So, corn. So you wind up not only getting rid of all the bread products that you easily recognize as bread, but also things like Coca-Cola, which during most of the year is made with corn syrup these days. You need to buy the special kosher for Passover Coca-Cola that is made with sugar, the way it used to be made.
Well, and how does one recognize the difference on the can?
Well, they're little symbols. Mm-hmm. And on Coke, for example, it will say probably OUP 2006 or OUP 06. The OU means it's certified by the Orthodox Union, and the 06 or 2006 tells you which Passover it's for.
And so what you've just been describing is, would be typical in Orthodox Jewish families, but I take it someone who's in a Reformed family might not do any of this?
Probably most would do some. Or all. Passover is probably the most enthusiastically celebrated holiday of the year. And people who may not be religious in any other way would have a Seder in their home or would attend a Seder or might eat matzah. So there's a whole range of, I mean, some people won't go to Seders, but I think more than 85% of Jews in the United States do participate in Passover in some way. So it can go all the way from people who do absolutely nothing to people who don't eat bread but eat matzah and make no other alterations to people who do an entire clean spring cleaning, change all of their dishes, change all of their cooking ware, and purchase food special for the whole holiday.
How easy is it for Orthodox Jews to buy the necessary things for Passover in the middle of Illinois?
It's a lot easier than it used to be. And I think that the local Jewish community, which is mostly Reform, appreciates the ease and celebrates very enthusiastically as well. There are several places that you can get kosher foods. The most extensive array of kosher foods for Passover for the last few years has been Schnucks, especially in Champaign. There are other stores that do carry kosher products, but that one has the largest selection.
Now, why is Passover the most enthusiastically celebrated religious holiday for religious festival for Jewish folks?
I think there are a couple of reasons. One of them is that it is one of the three biblically mandated pilgrimage holidays, and so it has a theological importance. The three biblically mandated holidays are Sukkot, which is in the fall, Passover, and Shavuot, which is in the spring. They're all agriculturally based holidays, and Passover is much more well-known than Sukkot and Shavuot in the United States, has been for a long time. And I think the reason for that has to do with two other issues. One is, what is it celebrating besides an agricultural holiday? And it's celebrating freedom, liberation from bondage, which is a really universal need.
Remind people who may not be familiar with the Jewish history what particular freedom it celebrates.
Well, it celebrates the story in Exodus where the Jews were, they first went down into Egypt because there was a famine in the land of Canaan during the time of Joseph. But they stayed, they were invited by the Pharaoh to stay, and they stayed 400 years. As the Bible says, a time came when a Pharaoh who didn't know the story of how they got there arose and decided that they would make good slaves. So they became enslaved. And after 400 years, Moses petitioned the Pharaoh repeatedly to let my people go. And eventually Moses did was successful, and Pharaoh let them go. They crossed the Red Sea. The Red Sea split to where the Sea of Reeds, actually, not necessarily the Red Sea. The sea split, and they went out of slavery and became a free people. But the other reason connected with this, why I think it's the most widely celebrated holiday, has to do with the family. Families convene. They may have family members spread out all over the United States, and they convene for the Passover Seder.
Before we talk more about the preparations and what actually happens at a Passover Seder, let me ask this most skeptical question, I suppose, and let me assure listeners, I'll be letting you ask your questions too in just a moment or two. But and I'll be giving the phone numbers where you can call. But just to start out with a skeptical question: all this stuff about Jews in Egypt, the Exodus, the plagues, Moses leading the people out. Archaeologists, you know, haven't found evidence in Egypt of this happening. Is there really a historical basis for this, or does it matter?
Well, I'm not an archaeologist or a historian. I can say to me it doesn't matter. To me, it's about the universal human urge to be free. And it's also about the spiritual covenant with God. So to me, the historicity of it is not so important. It's the great myth of the foundation of this culture. If you don't believe it, if you do believe it, it's the literal truth. It may be somewhere in between the two of those, but it's like the historicity of Christ is questioned by many. And yet that doesn't stop Christians from believing that he existed and that he is the Messiah.
Some who who've looked at the issue of the historicity of the Passover say, well, you know, if it did happen, Egypt wouldn't have much reason to brag about it and keep good records. So. Let me do give out the phone numbers for callers who'd like to ask our guest today, Lee Malhado. Dr. Malhado is Executive Director of the Champaign-Urbana Jewish Federation, and we're talking about the Passover Seder that will be celebrated by the Jewish community around the world beginning April 12. The phone numbers here on this live call-in show in Champaign-Urbana, you can reach several local lines by punching in 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, the call letters of the station, of course. Anywhere else the program is heard, including on the Internet, you may punch in 1-800-222-9455 for a toll-free call to the station. That's 1-800-222-WILL for listeners outside of Champaign-Urbana, and inside Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Lee, let's go back to talk about the preparation. The Seder itself is a meal. Mm-hmm. With many symbolic elements, many rituals included in it, but it's once, right? It's one meal, or did you say in some cases it's two?
If you reform, it's one.
Okay.
Unless you go to the congregational one, which they do celebrate on the second night.
Okay.
In conservative and orthodox, it's two meals.
But even at two, it's still relatively a short. In terms of time, event, and yet the preparations for it take a lot of time. So you're really anticipating it for how long?
You usually start right after Purim's over, which is about a month earlier, and by 2 weeks before, you really have to be into it.
And we've talked about some of the preparations in an Orthodox family, and you say 85% of Jews tend to celebrate this
right.
in some
so
form.
A lot of people in town are doing this. It's not just the Orthodox.
Okay.
And it's just, you know, how much they do and exactly how they do
sure.
it.
Well, tell us, what's the fun part for you?
Well, I like the family element of it. I like having guests over. I like the cooking. And I like the whole spiritual rhythm of the year, the way the different holidays go from one to another. This is probably the most exciting.
Mm-hmm. What does it mean to you?
Well, to me, it is about freedom, and freedom in the most general sense. I mean, some people sing the African-American spiritual Go Down Moses, and they identify very strongly with the African-American community in the United States, and worked hard in the 60s for emancipation and voting rights. Well, not emancipation, but voting rights. And they worked for emancipation during the Civil War period. I think Jews identify very strongly with peoples who have been enslaved and who work in their lives today and throughout history to assist people. One of the things that we're taught during the Seder is we're not just remembering what happened to our ancestors thousands of years ago. We are placing ourselves in their shoes. We are to experience the event as though it happened to us. And I think that teaches empathy for people, it teaches respect for freedom and teaches that it's something that you have to nurture and fight for every day and in all times for all people.
You've talked about this being a family event. It happens at home.
Right.
And how do people know what to do?
Well, there's a book called the Haggadah that is hundreds and hundreds of years old, and it means the telling. And you're commanded to tell the story. And the Haggadah is laid out in an order. The word Seder means order. And the Haggadah lays out the order of the things that you do, the symbolic elements, when it is that you eat, what that means. when the songs are sung, when the prayers are said, which prayers are said. The children are encouraged to ask questions. There's a place in the first half of the Seder where the youngest child present usually sings the four questions, usually in Hebrew. And it's kind of interesting when there are not kids. It's up for grabs who gets to do that. And again, it's usually the youngest person or perhaps the most recent convert.
And also, there are often guests at a Seder who may not even be Jewish.
Right. And so people are encouraged to ask questions. Children are encouraged. Adults are encouraged. Guests are encouraged. Asking questions and learning are what it's all about. And it's done in a fun context. Some of the readings are number games and jokes. And the songs are enthusiastic. And there are things that many of them are very repetitive. And they're obviously children's songs. And there's a tradition of stealing the half of the middle matzah that has to be saved until the end of the meal. It's called the afikomen. And the children they have to steal this during, it's their duty to steal this. And then they hide it. So this usually keeps them very much on their toes. And the meal usually takes a couple of hours, so they have a while to do it. But getting the person who is the leader out of the room or not paying attention to where he has hidden the matzah is difficult, and the kids love it. And then when it's time to use the afikomen at the end of the meal, the kids usually negotiate a gift. Mm-hmm. They hold the afikomen in ransom.
You said that questions were appreciated at a Passover Seder. We have our first question from a caller on line number one.
Oh,
you're
good.
On Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please.
Yes, please. Thank you so much for explaining. I've been to a Seder before. I'm not Jewish. But my question to you is, Jesus was a Jew, and this program is about keeping the faith. Could you explain to me why Jews are not Christians?
Well, the real direct, simple difference between Jews and Christians is that Christians accept Christ as the Messiah. And Jews don't.
Okay.
From a Jewish perspective, Christ is not seen as the Messiah for a couple of reasons. One is that Christians feel that Christ is divine.
Yeah.
And to Jews, the Messiah is not going to be divine.
Mm-hmm.
To Jews, it's impossible for a human being to be either divine or part divine. That's
okay.
Divinity is only capable for God.
Yeah.
Another reason is that the Jewish concept of the Messiah coming, once the Messiah is here, there will be universal peace, and there is not universal peace. So
really?
To the Jewish mind, that means that the Messiah has not come.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for being on the program and for keeping the faith.
Well, you're welcome.
In terms of the caller's question about Jesus, many, I guess I shouldn't say many, but there are some Christians who somehow don't realize that Jesus was a practicing
Jew. Yes,
and,
he was.
And very observant, apparently, as far as the Christian records show. What does that mean for Jewish-Christian relations, that there are Christians who do see Jesus as divine and human and spiritualize that notion of peace and say, well, that can be understood in a spiritual way, not necessarily in a political way?
Well, I think Christ, having been Jewish, has many possible different meanings and has had different meanings for different segments of the Christian community today and throughout history. Sometimes it means a real deep understanding and appreciation of the tremendous similarities in our religions and in their historical evolution one from the other, that many Christians are very attracted to Judaism and feel very positively about Judaism because they recognize the roots of their own religion through their own deity in Judaism. Other Christians at other times, or maybe even now, are very angry with the Jews for not having accepted Christ as divine. So, and they have then seen Jews as heretical or uncooperative, people who don't deserve to be who they are.
And as targets for conversion.
And as targets for conversion, yeah. Mm. So there are different responses.
We've talked about at the Passover Seder, guests are invited. I've been to some, and I've had Jewish friends in the past invite me, and I've been happy to go and enjoyed it. But I never quite knew how I was selected. Who gets invited?
People you know think it would be fun to invite you. I mean, there's no list. there's no list of specifications.
Or, so it is up to individual families.
Sure.
Some people do. Some people would rather not.
Some people are uncomfortable with non-Jews there because they feel looked at and they feel on display and makes them feel uncomfortable. Other people love sharing it and are just really happy to have non-Jews there.
We have another caller waiting to speak with our guest, Lee Malhado. You're on Keeping the Faith.
Hi there. This is I find this a wonderful show.
Thank you.
The Seder, I'm not a practicing Jew, and I've been to a couple Seders, though, and I've been to a couple other Jewish ceremonies. And as a secular Jew or maybe a non-Jew, it's a wonderful experience. I encourage everybody to try it out. It's just it's interesting food and a touching, thrilling story. It's just really great. And you had also talked about the historical background of it, and I don't know that I can speak with any authority on it, but there is an interesting movie that I got at Rentertainment recently. It purports to be a documentary of the sort of Discovery Channel kind, where they don't really draw any firm conclusions, but it talks about some locations in Saudi Arabia where they some people feel very sure that they've found the historical trail of Moses. So not in Egypt, as it's normally tracked.
Well, thank you for sharing that.
What's the movie called?
I don't know. I think it's I don't know. But
it's in the documentary section.
It's in the documentary section, okay. Yes.
Thank you very much.
Well, no problem.
Appreciate
the call. Probably Google it.
All right, thank you. In terms of the caller's reference to interesting food, maybe it's because we're approaching the dinner hour, but somehow I would like to hear about the food at a Seder. Remind me and tell our listeners.
I'm sure the menu varies somewhat perhaps extensively from one family to the next. Maybe I should talk first about the ritual elements that are present. The Seder plate has on it at least five things. It has a shank bone, an egg, a bitter herb, which is called maror, a vegetable that is like an appetizer called karpas, and a mixture of chopped apples and nuts and wine called haroset. And each of those has a symbolic meaning. The shank bone symbolizes the Pesach sacrifice in the temple. And it's just a bone that is burnt. Usually it's heated, cooked in an oven beforehand. But there's no meat on it. And most people will not eat a roast for Pesach because you would be eating the temple sacrifice, which we can't do because the temple isn't there. So it's there symbolically, but it's not eaten.
And Pesach is another word for?
Well, Pesach is another word for Passover. And the word itself, Passover, has to do with the 10th plague in which the firstborn Egyptians were killed, including the firstborn of the animals, by God as the last very severe statement to Pharaoh that he needed to let the Jews leave. And the Jews, the Jewish firstborn, were spared because they were told to take the blood of the sacrificed animal and put it a mark on their doorpost so that the angel of death would know which house to take the firstborn and which house not. So that's what the word Passover means, and Pesach means the same thing. So the one thing on the plate then is the reminder of the Paschal sacrifice, or the lamb that was eaten in ancient times. There was actually the lamb was sacrificed and eaten by the family. Had to be eaten all that day. You couldn't save it. The egg is a symbol of a lot of different things. It's a symbol of mourning. Round foods are like lentils, and eggs are taken to families who have just lost loved ones. So it's a symbol of the mourning for the destruction of the temple. It's also, as in Christianity, a symbol of joy and fertility and rebirth. And it's also a symbol for a metaphor for the Jewish people, which is that no matter how many times they've been tried to be killed, no matter how hard they're squeezed and persecuted, the harder you squeeze and persecute them, the more tenacious they try to survive. And so that's the way an egg is. The harder you cook it, the longer you cook it, the harder it gets. And then the maror is the bitter herb, and sometimes that's romaine lettuce. Sometimes it's horseradish, and some families use both. And that's a reminder of the bitterness of slavery. The karpas is the vegetable, which is actually a reminder of that it's a celebratory meal, and it's taken from Greek and Roman kind of hedonism at the time of the great celebrations and festivals that they had where they ate lots and lots and lots. And so usually people use parsley, and they dip it before they eat it. They dip it in salt water, and again, the salt water is to remind you of the tears of the bondage and the slavery. And then the haroset, this mixture of apples and nuts and wine that's all mashed up, chopped up, represents the mortar that held the bricks together, the things that the Jews had to make the bricks and then construct things. And so the haroset is the mortar.
We're talking with Lee Malhado, who is the executive director of the Champaign-Urbana Jewish Federation, about Passover. And we're about halfway through our program. Let me give our phone numbers again in case there are listeners who have questions or would like to make comments. 1-800-222-9455. We'll put you on the air with our guest. That's a toll-free number for any outside the Champaign-Urbana listening area. In Champaign-Urbana, punch in 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Keeping the Faith on AM 580 is a live program each Sunday night from 5 to 6, now Central Daylight Time. And this time of year, we're heard from Chicago to Indianapolis and places in between. We do cherish listeners' calls and questions, and are happy to have you participate in the program. Coming up next week on Keeping the Faith, our guest will be Bill Meyer, who is pastor of Twin City Bible Church. We'll be talking about evangelical Christian social action. That's April 9. The following week, Judith Valente and Charles Renard will be talking about their recent poetry collection, published just this year, 20 Poems to Nourish Your Soul. On April 23rd, the topic will be the Bible and the public schools. And our guests will be from the Program for the Study of Religion. Larry Lieberman will be our guest April 30th, reading from his most recent collection of new and selected poems, Carib's Leap. That's C-A-R-I-B, apostrophe S, Carib's Leap. Larry Lieberman's on the faculty at the University of Illinois and an internationally known poet, so we're happy to have him be our guest the last week in April. Support for these Keeping the Faith programs is provided in part by the University YMCA here at the University of Illinois, where I'm the executive director. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs. The Y is the oldest religious institution at the university. It was started by students back in 1873, and since that time has been providing opportunities for students to be involved in community service. For example, we have programs such as Vis-a-Vis, where students volunteer to tutor in the public schools. We do need to make another weather announcement at this time, and we'll hear that right now. Thank you, Denise Perry, and stay tuned to WILL, of course, for further breaking weather news. Getting back to Keeping the Faith, I was explaining about the University Y's support for this program. Coming up at the Y this week, our guest on Know Your University this week will be Bruce Knight. That's April 4, Tuesday at noon. He'll be talking about keeping our campus safe. Bruce will be representing the Campus Area Transportation Study Committee. So that important topic at the Y this Tuesday noon. It's a free lecture and a chance to talk about that issue with our guest speaker, Bruce Knight. If you'd like to make reservations, do call the Y for a lunch reservation with the Thai Eatery. That's 337-1500. If you forget, just come anyway. We'll find a plate for you. And you can, of course, bring your lunch as well. That's Tuesday, Know Your University, April 4. Coming up at Friday Forum at the Y this April 7th, Leah Bartelt will be representing, who is from the American Civil Liberties Union in Illinois, will be talking about legal threats to accessing reproductive health care. Leah will be talking at the Y Friday at noon. The Y is at 1001 South Wright Street. That's the corner of Wright and Chalmers. Parking is often available at parking meters about that time of day as students are leaving that area of campus for lunch, but you can also easily ride buses to the University Library corner and walk the half block to the Y. Coming up at the Y on April 21st is our annual auction. One of the ways this charity is supported is by people who give some wonderful gifts, very creative gifts, including this year a week or 10 days at an apartment on the Spanish Riviera. One of our supporters is donating this for an auction item. We also have things much closer to home, including White Sox tickets, for example, in Chicago, and many things in the Champaign-Urbana area. So do come out for a silent and live auction dinner. It will be at the Y this year with a wonderful catered meal and donated wine, and should be a wonderful evening again. That's April 21. If you'd like to make a reservation, do call the Y at 337-1500. Well, let's get back to our guest today, Lee Malhado. Dr. Malhado is director of the Champaign-Urbana Jewish Federation. We're talking about the Passover, and we were just getting into the talk about the food, which I was loving, but let's talk about wine. There's also four glasses of wine, as I recall.
Right. Four glasses of wine, two in the early part of the meal and two in the later part of the meal. And then the other ritual food is matzah. Now, this does not mean that this is all there is for dinner, but the things that I've mentioned so far are all
the ritual elements.
The ritual elements.
Sure.
And the four cups of wine represent the four promises that God makes to the Jewish people, that he'll bring the Jewish people out from under the bondage in Egypt. He'll bring them out from under their burdens. He'll redeem them with an outstretched arm, and he'll take them for a people. And there's actually a fifth controversial cup of wine, which is called Elijah's cup. And it's usually put in the center of the table and filled. And again, a kid usually will sneak part of it for the meal, during the meal, or sometimes an adult will, to prove that Elijah came. And that is about the fifth promise, I will bring you into the land. But there's rabbinical argument about whether there should be four cups or five cups. So the way they resolve this is that everybody drinks the four cups, and then there's this fifth cup in the center of the table that's not drunk by everybody else.
Now, this seems like a lot of wine, particularly to some of our non-alcoholic drinking folks, listeners. do people get drunk at the Seder?
Not usually. For one thing, it generally takes anywhere from, depending on the family, anywhere from 2 to 4 or 5 hours to go through the whole Haggadah. So you're drinking these cups of wine over a very long period of time.
At least at the Seders I've been to, the wine glasses are not very large.
Well, there is a stipulated amount. I think it's 3 ounces or 3.5 ounces per cup.
So about half of what a usual glass of wine
would
be. Right,
but it doesn't have to be wine. And if there are people who can't deal with wine because they're on medication or because of their age, either old or young, they can drink grape juice instead. And we always make sure there's plenty of grape juice, and quite a number of people will take the grape juice instead of the wine. Or you can mix them if you wish.
So there's always an alternative.
Yes. There's it's the fruit of the vine, so it doesn't matter whether it's wine or whether it's grape. It fulfills the ritual either way. But the other thing is that you're eating a lot of food with this.
Tell us about the food.
Okay. And the meals will often start off with matzo ball soup. And sometimes that contains vegetables in it as well, carrots, or might even have some chicken in it. There's usually a salad of some type, and a very frequent accompaniment with the salad is gefilte fish. And those are sort of the appetizers. It's usually followed by some type of meat, which is often turkey or chicken. It may be something else, but those are two kind of classical ones. And then you might have potatoes or squash or both. You might have asparagus or green beans or dressing that goes with the... I mean, it's kind of like Thanksgiving when you get right down to it. Then for desserts, there very often is fruit. Frequently this time of year, strawberries are very good. Might be pears, might be oranges, and lots of chocolate and baked delicacies that are made in a way that does not require you to use leaven. We make my husband makes this amazing torte that is chocolate and crushed nuts, and it is absolutely exquisite. People often ask him for the recipe. So there's lots of desserts at the end as well. Frequently there's nuts, one kind and another, pistachios, almonds, whatever. So by the time the meal is over, even though you've been eating it over a 4 or 5 hour period, people are usually full to the ears.
And four to 5 hours sounds like an awfully long time, but I can remember being at Seder's and not realizing how fast the time was going because it's interspersed with song and children are doing various things. And and the words in the Haggadah are so moving.
They are.
And many of them are straight from the Tanakh,
from the
Jewish
Bible. That's true.
Tell us a little bit about the Haggadah, the book that that has the words.
Well, the Haggadah means the telling, and it was written a long time ago. The earliest written versions of it that exist come from the Mishnah, which was created in the period between 0 and 500 CE. And by the year 200, there's a very clear description of the Seder and what later came to be the contents of the Haggadah. There were a few additions during the Talmudic period, and there were a few additions in the Middle Ages.
I want to continue with that in just a moment. We do have a caller waiting. Let's go to line number one again. You're on Keeping the Faith.
Hello. My question is a curiosity question that I've had, and my friend's mom, who's a rabbi, couldn't answer it to my satisfaction, and I was hoping you could.
I'm not a rabbi.
No pressure.
Well,
we'll see.
Give it a try.
Well, let's see. Maybe you can at least shed some light that she didn't shed. Let me put it that way. Okay. And that is, I have a curiosity as to whether or not it's just a cultural tradition for Ashkenazi Jews to have unleavened and Sephardic Jews to be able to eat rice. But every Ashkenazi Jewish friend that I've had and family and actually in their family members and my friend's mom, who's a rabbi, says that the unleavening, that even Ashkenazi Jews cannot eat rice.
Yes, that's true.
And I would love to know how, why, scriptural, is it dietary?
It's not scriptural, it's tradition. And there's a very clear difference between the Ashkenazi and the Sephardic community on this issue. The rabbis in the Ashkenazi areas, which would be Eastern Europe and Europe and Russia, they, over the course of the Middle Ages, decided that not only would these five grains be forbidden, the five grains are forbidden by Talmudic discussion, but in addition, one shouldn't grind other things which also look like flour. And rice can be turned into flour. I mean, you can make rice flour pancakes, for example. So they began to extend other things that could be ground and could be used to substitute for flour and to forbid those as well. Whereas the Sephardim, who lived more in the Mediterranean and the African and East Asian areas, Middle Eastern areas, they did not develop this this stricture, this stringency. And so these things are called, by the way, they're called kitniot. There's a specific name for them. So the things that the Sephardim can eat and that the Ashkenazi cannot, they're called kitniot. And they're things like rice and peas. And does that answer your question?
We had to cut off because we do need to go to Ed Kieser for another weather announcement. Thank you, Ed. We're back on Keeping the Faith. Our guest is Lee Malhado, who has not run for cover yet. So we're okay in Champaign County, at least so far. We'll keep listeners apprised, of course, as things change as soon as we have any word. Lee, the last caller, was talking about differences between Jewish folks from different parts of the world, different histories. How much is in common and how much are there differences in terms of celebrating the Passover Seder?
Well, there's a lot in common. The Haggadah, as I say, dates back from a long time ago, long before most people were totally dispersed throughout those regions. And the differences between the Ashkenazi and Sephardic Jews were not profound yet. So they all started with the same thing. Mm-hmm. There are these differences of what you can and cannot eat at Passover. There, in general, the Sephardim appear to have made more easy accommodations to the cultures that surrounded them, that they lived within. And so the interaction, the creative interaction and changes within Judaism are greater there. There's less apartness. The Jews in Europe were more ghettoized and were also more legalistic in their thinking and developed more strictness about a lot of things. Mm-hmm. But they're way more alike than they are different.
Let's talk about some of the positives, because some people, when they hear about Passover preparations, they hear the negatives, no yeast, not these five grains and so forth. But there's so much in the Passover Seder celebration that does focus on positives. Yes, it's the tradition. Yes, it's the history. But there's also, it's sort of a teaching, isn't it?
Well, it's very much a teaching. It's very much encouraging questioning, encouraging curiosity. The whole family is involved. The children usually help with the cleaning. They help make decorations. They help plan the Seder itself. They're, in many families, they're encouraged to have a speaking part. If they can read at all, if they can read in English, they read in English. If they can read in Hebrew, they read in Hebrew. Their questions are taken, the children's questions are taken as seriously as the adults' questions. I mean, it's a very warm, very accepting environment. They're lots of noise and running around. Nobody is expected to sit still and be quiet. They're a little bit of chaos. And I think most people even don't experience all of the don'ts as negatives. It's only 1 week out of a year. And a lot of the things that you can't eat, then the trick and the question and the fun becomes in, well, we can't eat that. What can we do? Sure. How can we make this work? And we used to ask our kids 2-3 weeks before Passover when we were beginning to buy the food, what would you like to have this Passover? What special foods do you want? What do you want to take in your lunches? So there's a lot of ownership.
Excuse me, we do need to break in for another weather announcement. Thank you, Ed Kieser, for that important announcement. We're back with our guest on Keeping the Faith. Sometimes these programs are more exciting than others.
And the other joy that's there is the content itself, which is about being released, being made free. It's about optimism. It's about being beloved of God's. It's about being a people together, being a community, being a family together. You really belong. And it's a very joyful time, very joyful thoughts, very joyful passages in history to remember, or scripture if you don't think it's history.
And it's not a stretch to be reminded that just as this program is being interrupted by the events, the real events, in this case, in Wayan weather, the Passover has been celebrated by Jews down through the centuries, down through the millennia, at times of great joy, but also at times of great sorrow and great risk and great danger. How has the Passover Seder functioned in those times?
Well, it has given people hope at times when it seemed hopeless. I mean, for example, in the concentration camps in Germany during World War II and in Poland, and where Jews were being killed by the thousands every day, the Jews who were in the camps, who had nothing, who were starving to death, would save food and set it aside and use it to prepare things. I've read some descriptions of how they used potatoes that they obtained to make matzah out of potatoes, and they said it was terrible, but it was so important to them spiritually to be able to do it, and they had to do it at night in hiding. People who had no Haggadahs would write them on scraps of paper, and they would get...
From memory,
and they would get a barracks of hundreds of people together, and each person would contribute what they remembered.
We have another caller on line number one for conversation with our guest Lee Malhado about Passover. Yes, go right ahead, and I do need to warn you, we might need to interrupt you.
I understand.
Yes.
I have a question about death, because I'm a nurse. What's the Jewish position about death? Because I know that it's different from the Christian. And I'll hang up and listen
about
to
death. Jewish position about death. I think she may be referring to Christian notions of resurrection, of a life to come, those sorts of things.
It's not got a lot to do with Pesach, but I guess in short, I should say that Judaism concentrates on this world much more than the world to come, but there is a Jewish concept of an afterlife, and some Jews believe in it and some Jews don't. Death is seen as the end of the world as we experience it. It's sad. It's the conclusion of something. And then some people believe there's a beyond, and some people believe that there isn't.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the actual Haggadah word, ceremony, ritual, could you give us a little hint, a little example for people who've never had the opportunity to actually participate in a Passover Seder? Could you give us just a sample passage of some of the things, some of the words that are read, that are recited?
Right. The opening words from the Maggid section, which are early, it's one of the first long readings, says, "This is the bread of affliction, which our ancestors ate in the land of Egypt. Let all who are hungry enter and eat thereof, and all who are in distress come and celebrate the Passover. At present we celebrate it here, but next year we hope to celebrate it in the land of Israel. This year we are servants here, but next year we hope to be free men in the land of Israel." The four questions, which many people wonder what they are, is a song that children sang in it. Ma nishtana halayla hazeh mikol halelot. That's the opening line. And it means, why is this night different from all other nights? Actually, that's a mistranslation. What it actually says is what a difference this night is, how different it is from other nights. Any other night we may eat either leavened or unleavened bread, but on this night only unleavened bread. All other nights we may eat any species of herb, but this night only bitter herbs. All other nights we do not dip even once, but on this night twice. All other nights we eat and drink either sitting or reclined, but on this night all of us recline. And so this is all showing all the things that I talked about before. There's stimulants to make people ask questions. It's all about the curiosity.
Now, the singing is fascinating to me because everyone participates, and these are songs that are sung enthusiastically, even by people with not much vocal experience or training, and yet it's great fun. What are instruments used?
No. I shouldn't say no categorically. That's unfair.
So it's not forbidden.
It depends on what community you're in. If you're in a Reform community, nobody would think twice about whether you played a musical instrument or not, and they might even put Passover music on the CD. They might have somebody playing a guitar or a flute or a clarinet, and all of that would be fine, and I'm sure it's done. In a traditional home, you don't play a musical instrument on a holiday, so no, there wouldn't. Singing is everything, but you wouldn't play instrumental music.
And do you know anything about the history of these songs? Are these tunes vary from place to place, tradition to tradition, or is there a uniformity? Are they written down? Are there musical notations?
There are. Well, by now there probably are, but it's mostly an oral tradition, and it's passed on from family to family, generation to generation. There are kind of several. The tune that I used for the four questions, Manish Tana, is a classical tune, but there's at least one other that I've heard, and many people seem to know both of the tunes. Some of the songs have multiple tunes for them. Some have only one. Many of the songs are children's songs. Like there's a song Chagadiah, which is it's a counting song for kids, and it's about one kid, one only kid.
As in goat.
Yes, as in a goat. There's a song in here that is another counting song that is very much like a Christian counting song.
So there's similarity even between different faiths.
Right.
Well, we've reached our end time here on Keeping the Faith today, and I want to thank our guest, Lady Vampato. There's much else we could be talking about the Passover, but thank her for putting up with the necessary interruptions because of the weather emergencies. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Next week, our guest will be Bill Meyer from Twin City Bible Church talking about evangelical Christian social action.